This is Audible.
Lamplight Audiobooks presents Master of War, Scourge of Wolves by David Gilman. Narrated by Colin Mace. After 23 years of fighting, King Edward III has agreed a treaty and released the French monarch from captivity in England, allowing him to return home. France is in chaos, flayed by mercenary bands, a situation which initially suits Edward, as it keeps the French king from regaining control. But the vast tracts of territory gained by the English need to be claimed, by force if necessary. French cities and towns' loyalties cleave them to their own king, but reluctantly, one by one, they succumb and agree to be ruled by the English. However, not all towns are so easily convinced. Belligerent lords and self-serving mercenary captains refuse. Thomas Blackstone and the renowned knight and king's negotiator, Sir John Chandos, are tasked with bringing the recalcitrant defaulters under English control. Outnumbered and still hunted by the French, Thomas Blackstone and his men face betrayal and a final suicidal mission. Prologue. Leicester, England, March 1361. King Edward III stood at the entrance to the room where Henry of Grosmont, Duke of Lancaster, his lifelong friend and adviser, lay dying. Lancaster raised his hand to stop the king from entering his bedchamber, fearing that the plague, which had once again started its journey of death across Europe, had now reached him. Edward hesitated. He was blessed by God in victory and peace. Should he challenge his own divine good fortune? He strode into the room and pulled an embroidered stool towards his friend's bed. The servants had been dismissed the moment the king mounted the stairs. The words exchanged between these two old warriors would be as private as any confessional. No whispers were to filter down towards waiting servants.
"Oh, my lord, I beg you. I know not what ails me, but it will take me. Step away."
Edward reached out a hand and clasped his friend's. "Age will bear us all away when it is good and ready, Henry. It is all in God's hands." The dying man wheezed.
"I am glad it takes me before you, sire. I would not bear the grief were it otherwise."
Edward squeezed his friend's cold fingers.
"So many battles, so many victories, and so many of us leaving less than our own shadow on the land," he said.
"You're wrong."
"We are never wrong. We are the king," said Edward, smiling.
"Ah, were it so, eh? No struggle with our own conscience or with those who would try to defeat us by fair means or foul."
Lancaster relented and reached out to grip the king's arm.
"You bless the realm with a burning sunlight that will cast your shadow across this great nation for lifetimes to come."
Edward's gaze settled with compassion on his ailing friend. How much time was there for any of them? The peace with France was barely delivered. More trials and contests would come their way. But those who had been at Edward's side since he seized the throne as a boy were becoming fewer and fewer in number. The Duke was one of those few.
"What is it we can do for you?"
Lancaster shook his head.
"Nothing for me, Edward. Everything for England."
Even lying on his deathbed, the renowned Duke's abiding concern was for the nation he had helped Edward build.
"A month passed, we saw the portents, the lights in the sky, the eclipse. They say the rain turned to blood in Boulogne. It heralds hard times again, Edward. The pestilence comes more quickly than the dawn. You must look to who can control the territories you have fought so hard for."
"Our firstborn, Edward, will govern Aquitaine. Lionel will go to Ireland. The Scottish already give us their allegiance."
and your sons and those they command will serve you well. But our old fraternity is lost. Brave Northampton is dead. Thomas Holland and Reginald Cobham are ailing, and many others are frail, taken one by one as night steals away the day. All gone, and I soon to follow. You have pursued your ambition, Edward. You have achieved greatness for this kingdom, and such an inheritance must have its guardian. When the time comes, who among the many leads by common consent? A man of loyalty, who will speak his mind even at great risk to himself.
Lancaster gave Edward a querying look. The king knew full well of whom he spoke. "Blackstone," said the king quietly. Lancaster smiled.
"As you said, dear friend, you are never wrong."
Part 1. In the King's Name. Limousin, France. December 1361. Chapter 1. Thomas Blackstone's men rode to their deaths. As they eased their horses through the town's narrow streets, Sir Gilbert Kilbert watched the townspeople, who moments before had cheered their arrival. Now, their faces filled with panic, some quickly turned away, others scuttled behind pillars. Kilbert knew immediately that he and his men had been lured into a trap by the ill-named Breton lord, Bernard de Charité, who commanded the citadel of Saint-Aubin-la-Ferre. Before he could call out a warning, crossbowmen appeared on the walls, and the first bolt struck home. Horses reared, men fell. An animal-like cry then soared up from the citizens, as lust for the Englishman's death twisted their features anew. Some dared to dash forward onto the bloodied ground and seize the fallen men's weapons. Soldiers appeared from the side streets and shop doorways and roughly pushed the townsmen aside to plunge sword and knife into Blackstone's wounded and dying men. Kilbert heeled his mount as his sword slashed two soldiers reaching up for him. Swinging the blade in swift practiced arcs, he slew three more as his warhorse kicked and turned. Kilbert was no stranger to the melee of war. He had fought at Blackstone's side since the boy became a man, and together they had taken part in every great battle and victory the English had secured in France and Italy. Now he was going to die in a piss-stinking alleyway. Swordsmen, jabbing low, thrust their blades deep into his horse's flanks and chest. The wild-eyed animal bellowed in pain, and Kilbert cursed as he crashed down into the mud. Desperately trying to parry the blows that assaulted him, he ripped his shield free from its saddle ties and rammed the sword upwards into the groin of one of his attackers. In his agony, the man barged into the others, while Kilbert, twisting, managed to haul the shield across his body. He felt the heavy impact as a mace slammed into it. A blade jabbed at his side. Slithering away, he struck out at the man's ankles and felt the steel cut deeply through unprotected flesh. The man fell, writhing, further obstructing the attackers. His screams joined the cacophony that echoed off the town's walls. One of the attackers threw himself across Kilbert's shield, smothering him with his weight as others grabbed his arms and yanked him upright. They had him now. Sweat and blood stung his eyes. He saw Blackstone's men going down from the overwhelming assault. Jack Halfpenny's archers had had no chance to unsheathe their war bows, so the battle-hardened men, the backbone of King Edward's army, fought with archer's knife, sword, and raw courage. An English archer's bow was of little use in such a confined place. Crossbowmen were better suited to close-quarters ambush, and de Charité had used them well. Kilbert saw the young Ventnor jig left and right, crying out for the 20 archers he commanded to fall back, but most were already dead or dying. So Halfpenny made one last desperate assault on the two men who cornered him. His archer's strength gave him the advantage, and he smashed his left fist into one man's face, half turned on his heel and slashed the long archer's knife across the other's throat. Kilbert struggled, brought up an elbow, and felt bone break in his captor's face. In that split second he saw Halfpenny take a stride towards him. The lad was already wounded in his side, but seeing Kilbert being held, was coming to his aid.
"No!" bellowed Kilbert. "Get Thomas!"
The warning shout was barely out when those who had held him clubbed him to the ground. The last thing Kilbert saw before a sickening darkness engulfed him was Jack Halfpenny running for his life. If anyone had a chance to escape, it was the lithe archer. That, at least, gave the old fighter a sense of satisfaction. By nightfall, the lifeless bodies of Thomas Blackstone's men hung from the gibbet in the town square. Every man displaced evidence of the wounds resulting from the betrayal and ambush by the town's lord. Shadows danced in the torchlight, as Saint-Aubin's men and women, relieved from the usual curfew, were permitted to desecrate the dead with knives and staves, making the corpses sway from the assault. 19 more of Blackstone fighters dangled outside of the high town walls, as a warning from Bernard de Charité. Halfpenny had escaped the slaughter amid a hue and cry that echoed around the walls. Clasping a hand over the wound in his side, he had forced himself to run hard and fast, despite the pain, through the labyrinthine alleys, until he found a niche in a wall that he could just squeeze into. When darkness fell, he had concealed his bow in a narrow crevice between pillar and lintel. It had been his father's war bow, and its heart wood that had bent beneath father and son's hand was as precious to Jack Halfpenny as the memory of the man who had taught him to use it. Pushing aside his regret, he made his way through the shadows until he reached the high walls. Once the night watch had turned their backs to cheer the brutality being inflicted on the corpses in the square below, he skirted the parapet. Grasping the hemp rope that held the dangling body of one of his men on the outside wall, he lowered himself 20 feet down. The corpse sagged as Halfpenny clutched at its clothing. Dried blood soiled the gaping mouth and swollen tongue, half severed by its teeth when the noose tightened. Halfpenny turned his face away from the man he had once commanded, hoping his weight would not tear the man's head from his neck as he slithered down the body, using it to gain extra length before having to release his grip and plunge into the dense briar patch 30 feet below. He prayed that the scattered moonlight did not conceal rocks beneath the thick foliage as he let go of the dead man and fell into the night. The following day's weak sun failed to burn away the mist that clung to the frost-covered land. Ignoring the morning chill and the skin-splitting roughness of the stone they handled, Perrine and Moulin worked alongside their men to heft stone onto the defensive wall of a ruined building. The rising ground gave the derelict barn a commanding position over the surrounding countryside. They were 12 miles from where the ambush took place in Saint-Aubin-la-Feur, and even though the shelter was temporary, Blackstone had demanded a low defensive wall be built. He and his men were tasked by the king's negotiator, Sir John Chandos, with securing towns ceded to King Edward in the peace treaty. At each village or town the burghers were called upon to pledge their allegiance to the English king. Some bemoaned what was asked of them, but eventually agreed when they gazed down from their walls at the battle-hardened men who made the demand. Others quickly saw the advantage of being under the protection of a strong warrior king, while their own recently released monarch languished in Paris, bankrupt and sorely pressed to keep control over what was left of his kingdom. France was soured by destroyed crops, poisoned wells, and the bitterness of defeat. Mercenaries who had fought on both sides of the war ravaged what little food and supplies remained. There were some French lords who resisted, handing over their towns to Blackstone and Chandos until money was exchanged, at which point French loyalties were switched with remarkable ease. Those who resisted most fiercely were mercenaries who served the Breton lords. A civil war was raging in Brittany, and lands as far south as the Limousin and Poitou were held by each of the warring factions. Saint-Aubin-la-Feur was one such town. Payment had been agreed for the Breton lord to turn over the town and for the burghers to swear allegiance to the English crown. Sir Gilbert Kilbert had taken 20 archers and as many hobelars into the fortified town to deliver the payment and receive their signed agreement. "Look," said Perrine, squinting into the morning sun, pointing to a lone figure emerging from the mist and stumbling across the open ground a half mile away. The men stopped work and watched the man stagger, raise an arm and then fall. Caution made the wall builders hesitate. The woodland that lay 300 paces to the man's flank might conceal an enemy. whoever it was that had fallen, could be bait for a trap. A warhorse jumped the low wall, scattering the men. Its dappled black coat looked as though it had been singed by a fire's embers, part of the reason for its reputation of having been sired in hell.
"It's Jack!" cried Blackstone, as he spurred the bastard horse on.
Moulin and Perrine grabbed their weapons and ran after him. The fluttering wings of a raptor caught Perrine's eye as it suddenly beat its way skywards from the forest. It made no sound until it found an updraft that spiraled it above Blackstone's race towards the fallen halfpenny. Perrine's heart shuddered, not from exertion, but from a long-held belief that the screech of a buzzard beckoned death as it called for a man's soul. And now it circled above Blackstone. As the two men ran forward, Blackstone's sentinel, Will Longdon, rallied the others behind the defensive wall.
"Stand ready!" he ordered.
Archers and men-at-arms swiftly prepared themselves for any attack that might surge from the woodland. Feet crunching on the hard frost, their breath billowing, Moulin and Perrine reached the fallen man at the same time as Blackstone's squire. John Jacob had caught up to them with one of the pack-horses. Blackstone's belligerent mount would never allow another to be put onto its back, and if Jack Halfpenny lived, then he needed a horse to bring him into the protective wall of the old barn.
"He's alive," cried Blackstone.
He picked up the unconscious man as if he were a child. John Jacob steadied the pack horse as Blackstone draped the wounded man over its withers. Moulin and Perrine had gone 20 paces beyond them, ready to guard against anyone who might have been in pursuit of their fallen comrade. If the buzzard's alarm was a portent of death for Thomas Blackstone, then the forest might cloak the enemy. Blackstone led his horse alongside John Jacob's slow-moving mount, which now carried Halfpenny. Once Perrine and Moulin were satisfied there was no ambush, they rejoined the others. Perrine kept glancing skyward, but the raptor had disappeared as quickly as it had appeared. As the five men made their way back to safety, the squire glanced at Blackstone.
"If Jack has made it back, what of Sir Gilbert?"
Blackstone looked around at the gentle undulating landscape. The countryside was plagued with routiers, and it was easy to be caught in the open.
"Moulin, you and Perrine run ahead and take 10 men back a couple of miles," he said. "Scout out the forester's tracks through the woods. If there's no sign of Sir Gilbert and the others, get back here quickly. And tell Will to ready a bed for Jack. He needs his wound attending to."
The hulking Norman spearman ran off with Perrine at his side. The air from the big man's breath freckled his beard with frost. Blackstone laid a hand on the unconscious man as the horse swayed.
"They might have run into skinners," he said.
Some of the mercenary bands numbered in their hundreds, and a small detachment of men, such as that led by Kilbert, could have been overwhelmed. France was more dangerous now than when the English had fought the French armies. Violence swept across the unprotected towns and villages, and the slaughter would continue until King Edward claimed what was rightfully his, and until the French king had reached a settlement with those who committed such carnage without fear of retribution. All were foolish enough to believe they could cause harm to any of Thomas Blackstone's men with impunity.
"But if those bastards at Saint-Aubin have betrayed us, I swear I'll burn it to the ground and kill every last one of them."
Chapter 2
Jack Halfpenny had quickly regained consciousness when nurtured with Will Longdon's broth, and the gash in his side had been treated and bound. Those who served with Blackstone no longer packed their wounds with cow dung and grass, because they had learnt better ways to treat their injuries from a woman who had once been thought a witch. She had been a herbalist, and accompanied Blackstone when, a year before, he had gone into Milan to kill the man responsible for ordering the death of his wife and child. The so-called Witch of Ballon had taught the men well, and shown them how to gather plants and herbs, even in winter, and to dress wounds without bleeding the wounded. That she had died under her own hand to save Blackstone made the men honour her memory. Halfpenny had insisted the slash in his side be bound tightly, and that he ride with Blackstone despite his hurt. Once Halfpenny had recounted the betrayal, anger swept through Blackstone's camp. Men seethed with desire for vengeance. They wanted Saint-Aubin raised to the ground. Blades were sharpened, and talk was of the slaughter to come. They waited, alert and impatient, at the camp while Blackstone took his captains to reconnoitre the town's defences. Blackstone and his captains were lying on the cold ground on the edge of a forest in the shade of its bare branches. They ignored their discomfort as they studied the walls of Saint-Aubin. Their friends' bodies still hung there in a grotesque symbol of defiance against the English king. Halfpenny squatted next to Blackstone and Will Longdon. Blackstone had questioned him carefully about Kilbert's fate, but the archer had only been able to tell what he saw. Kilbert had been beaten into the dirt.
"We rode in through the east gate. Bernard de Charité stood on the gatehouse wall and welcomed us, said he accepted the payment for the town and would sign the treaty himself." Will Longdon spat. "Now the horse son has taken the payment and killed my archers."
"And the men-at-arms?" said Blackstone, quietly, without censure, keeping his attention on the high walls behind which half of his force had been betrayed and slaughtered.
"Aye, I wasn't forgetting them,"
admitted Blackstone's sentinel, who, despite his rank, had had only 60 archers under his command, a number now reduced to 40. Those 20 dead men, who could loose a dozen and more yard-long, bodkin-tipped shafts in rapid succession, were precious resources lost to any group of fighting men. The men-at-arms, who laboured in hand-to-hand combat, stank of sweat and piss as they took the fight to their enemy. But an archer, merciful Christ, Will Longdon crossed himself, an archer was worth his weight in gold, and no other man's stench ever smelled sweeter.
"But our bowmen, Thomas, they can't be replaced as easily as a man-at-arms."
Blackstone looked back at him. Longdon shrugged. The truth was the truth.
"A man like Sir Gilbert was worth 10 men-at-arms, Will. Let's not forget that," said Blackstone, and then crawled back deeper into the woodland to receive the reports from Perrine and Moulin's scouts.
One of the captains, the German man-at-arms, Renfred, shook his head.
"There's no way to scale those walls, Sir Thomas. 50 feet high, at least, and over there."
He gestured to where he had just returned from his reconnaissance.
"They have cut the forest back even further. Open ground for at least 400 yards. If they don't invite us in, then I cannot see how we breach the walls. There's a lake that covers the other half of the town. No drawbridge, no postern gate to give access to the water."
John Jacob studied the battlements, and took the twig that he was chewing to point out the irregular shape of the town's defences.
"And even if we got under their walls with ladders, they would have us in enfilade. Their crossbowmen would cut us down as we assembled the ladders."
"And we cannot get close enough to mine the walls," said Moulin.
"This is why Chandos wanted it under the king's control. It's a stronghold worth depriving his enemies of," said Blackstone.
His stonemason's eyes studied the walls. They were of recycled stone, a usual means of building up fortifications over the years. Such construction didn't require the skill of a stonemason's cut, but of sufficiently experienced men to lay the stone with mortar. The walls at Saint-Aubin were well built. The expertise of earlier stonemasons, who once cut stone for another building nearby, probably a manor house or convent, benefited those who came later. Demolish the old and rebuild the new. Good walls, but once Blackstone was inside them, he knew how to bring them down, even though John Chandos and the king wanted the fortress to remain intact.
"Jack," he said, turning to the bandaged archer, who sat propped against a tree, his hand pressing the wound, which still seeped blood. "What can you remember about the layout? How do we get to de Charité's keep?"
Halfpenny's brow furrowed. He shook his head.
"Like a whore's heart," said Thomas. "Impossible to reach. A portcullis after the main gate, winding streets, alleyways and small cloisters running along the street, Some of the merchants plied their wares under them, stalls and such like. I remember them selling bread off one. That smell of baked bread was the last thing I remember before the killing started.
Then they've enough grain and fuel for their ovens, said Will Longdon. They'll have months' worth to withstand a siege.
No one's going to lay siege, said Blackstone. I want to get inside the horse heart and cut it out. Jack?
Halfpenny nodded. Knowing the more he could recall, the better their chance would be of successfully storming the town. He also knew from experience that his archer's eye always took in more than at first he realized.
The houses are tightly packed on one side of the street they took us down. That's where they ambushed us, he said. We couldn't turn the horses. We had no chance, and Sir Gilbert had men swarming over him. We fought as best we could, but when I tried to reach him, he commanded me to escape. I hid in a small overhang. That's where I left my bow. He glanced at Will Longdon. I don't want any barrel bow, he insisted, disdain for the army's replacements, all painted white and packed in barrels, in his voice. Mine belonged to my father, and I want it back.
Blackstone placed a hand on his shoulder. And you will, but we need to know more. He turned back into the forest.
Renfred, take me to the north walls. I want to see for myself.
The men skirted St. Aubin along Forester's tracks. What they saw convinced Blackstone that an assault would be impossible without a greater force prepared to suffer casualties. By the time they reached the edge of the lake, it was obvious that the Lord of St. Aubin had been blessed with a surrounding landscape that offered him maximum security. As Renfred had said, the open ground was cleared back to the forest by 400 yards, and from where the men now huddled in the dank gloom of the forest, the frozen lake stretched the same distance to the base of the sheer walls. Halfpenny pointed towards those imposing walls.
Where I hid, there were steps close by that took me up to the wall head. They hanged the lads from the walkways behind the parapets. I looked over those walls when I escaped, but I knew I couldn't drop down into the lake. I'd have died under the ice. That's why I went over the south wall.
He turned to look at the bodies that still hung there.
There's a kitchen window in the north wall, 40 feet up. It's a big place, and on the other side is a walkway like a narrow bridge across the street below. It connects the kitchen to the main house. It leads through the pantry on this side and the buttery on the other. Once you're through that passage, you're into the great hall.
How could you know that? Said John Jacob.
I was lying in an alcove beneath that walkway. I could hear everything that was being said by the servants. I could smell the food and heard what was to be taken where. They were laughing, talking about how de Charité had fooled us. They were leaving their duties to go down into the square. They took kitchen knives and cleavers. Sir Thomas, I saw what they did to the men they hanged. The lord of the town let the people mutilate and beat them. Two of the wounded men, Haskin and Fowler, were chased around the square until they were hacked to death. The crowd pissed on their bodies before they died. Those bastards in St. Aubin hate the English.
And I will give them an even greater reason, said Blackstone.
But you didn't see Sir Gilbert's body?
No. I saw him strapped down, but nothing more.
The king wants that town, Sir Thomas, said Moulin. It's important to him.
Ye man, Sir John.
Aye, well, the king can't always have what he wants, added Will Longdon. And Sir John Chandos might be a knight of the garter and a king's negotiator with these scum, but he can kiss my arse if he thinks we've ladders long enough to clamber up any of them walls with their crossbowmen picking us off. And that ice wouldn't take the weight of a fairy's fart, let alone men and ladders.
Your arse could be offered to them as a target while we assault the south walls. What say you, Sir Thomas? Said Moulin.
Sir Gilbert kicked Will's backside often enough, and I suspect he'd like to do it again, if he still lives. So we had better keep Will's arse in his breeches.
Blackstone and his captains eased back into the trees where the horses were tethered.
We have to take the town, and Sir John is due to join us tomorrow. We need his men.
A coldness gripped Blackstone's chest, which had nothing to do with the chilled air. To picture his men butchered filled him with a bitterness eased only by the desire to avenge them, but to think of Kilbert being slain in such a fashion put steel into his heart. His mind's eye saw the French oriflamme, the great war standard raised in battle against the English. He wished he had seized it when he struck out at the French king at Poitiers. He would raise it now. It signalled no quarter.
Chapter 3 What keeps a man alive when he is held prisoner alone without the comfort of comrades or the chance of escape is his own courage and a silent contempt for his captor. When the same man is strapped to a post in the town square, surrounded by the stench of his hanged and mutilated men, it is a determination to somehow find a way to strike back and kill his enemy. They had stripped the injured Kilbert down to his breeches and roped him to a post. He had been pelted with human and animal excrement. The chilled air had dried the blood from the blow to his head, encrusting it onto his scalp and beard. No knife or cleaver had been used against him, but they had doused him with water and let it freeze on him, so that it shrank the ropes that held him even tighter. His muscles had stiffened, but he had kept his head raised and stared at his persecutors as they darted forward and struck him with switches. The slender, flexible tree shoots stung as they nicked his flesh. The children tormenting Kilbert scattered when their Breton warlords strode into the square on the third day of his capture to give the veteran knight water.
"You're my ransom, old man," said the Charité. "When Chandos comes knocking at my gates, I will make even more money from your king. I know you by name and reputation. You are worth more alive than dead."
The Breton nodded to his soldiers, who grabbed Kilbert's hair and pulled back his head so that another could ladle water into his mouth. Kilbert choked and gasped, but the water would revive him enough to put strength back into his muscles.
"You do not taunt the King of England by betraying him, you stupid bastard."
"I'll die here at this stake before that happens," Kilbert gasped,
"and you'll be hunted like a sewer rat."
The Breton was immune to the threat.
"Kilbert, you are a fool. Chandos will pay. Your King Edward backs Jean de Montfort to rule Brittany. My King John arms and supports Charles de Blois. I will stay here at Saint-Aubin and hold the roads north to Paris and west to the Breton march. There are hundreds of routiers riding from the east. Some go south to seize what's left of this country. Others ride here to reinforce us. Both kings seek to bribe the routiers to fight for them, and if they cannot be bought, then they must be defeated. Chandos needs men who can command. He'll pay to get you back, and he will pay for me to convince those who come to support us that their fortune lies elsewhere."
Crows fluttered overhead, settling onto the decaying corpses of Kilbert's men.
"Take down my men and bury them, you vile dog-turd," said Kilbert.
One of the soldiers punched Kilbert's stomach. The veteran knight's head doubled over the ropes that bound him. He spewed what water he had taken. Sucking air into the pain, he forced his head back against the post and sneered.
"Your men must be used to squeezing a whore's tit. They hit like parlourmaids."
The soldier raised his arm to strike Kilbert across the face, but de Charité gestured him to stop.
"Sir Gilbert, I've seen English arrogance before in the face of an overwhelming enemy. It gives you false courage."
"We don't need false courage against murdering scum, and we fought your perfume-sniffing king no matter how big his army, and won. Look at me, you Breton whore son. You spill your seed into whores and breed bastards. One chance is all I need, and my face will be the last thing you will see before you die.
I will take you limb from limb and then spill your guts while you still live. Your head will be sent to Paris with your puny cock shoved into your ear."
Bernard de Charité took a couple of quick strides and grabbed Kilbert's throat.
"Then perhaps I should take your head now and deliver that to your king," he hissed,
spittle flecking Kilbert's face.
"Do it. Send him my head, and then by all that is holy, you will burn alongside every other wretch in this town. Now take the stench of your dog's ass breath out of my face."
The Charité slapped Gilbert hard. The blow split his lip, blood spilling onto his beard. The Breton turned on his heel.
No more water for him!
Gilbert raised his head and roared in defiance of pain and death. Children scattered as women darted forward to snatch at them. The sooner their lord put him to death, the safer they would all feel. The Englishman was possessed. Blackstone and his surviving men waited for the mist to clear on the lower slopes of his encampment. The morning sun's valiant efforts to break through the stubborn shroud were once again defeated. The coldest winter for years froze the droplets of mist onto the bare branches. Crystals of light glittered. Men wrapped their rotting boots in torn cloth and bound their hands to keep the skin from splitting and their fingers agile. The muffled sound of approaching horses and the creak of leather filtered through the mist. Will Longdon and the archers had already nocked their arrows. If it was an enemy, then many would die in their saddles before Blackstone's fighters put them to the sword. Indistinct voices complaining of being lost told Blackstone and the others that at least some of the unseen men were English. But it was no reason to lower their guard because there were notorious bands of English mercenaries across France. Men like James Pipe, Robert Knowles, hardened leaders of tough men released from military service, many of whom were felons, granted pardons by King Edward to fight in his army. And now the war was won, these killers roamed freely across France. Edward did not encourage the brigands, but it had seemed preferable that they harass the French rather than return home and become outlaws on English roads. However, if they threatened Edward's peace treaty and the towns that now belonged to him, they would need to be defeated. A horse appeared, and its rider's shield bore a gash of red, a downward-pointing diamond blazon.
"Sir John!"
Blackstone cried out. The leading horseman, startled by the sudden challenge, pulled up his horse, and like ghosts emerging from a haunted marshland, others drew up alongside him. The horseman called out,
"Thomas! Merciful Christ, you could have killed us!"
He urged his horse forward to where Blackstone and his men-at-arms stood ready to fight. John Jacob took the horse's reins as the renowned knight and negotiator dismounted. Blackstone eased Wolf's sword into its scabbard as Chandos glanced at the line of bowmen. He extended his gloved hand in greeting.
"Thomas!" The man's bowels turned to water when suddenly confronted by English bowmen. "I praise God I was not born a Frenchman,"
he said, his eyes twinkling with humour. He was 10 years older than Blackstone, and his grip told of strength forged from a lifetime of swordsmanship. More of Chandos's men rode forward into the clear air. Moulon, Perrine, and John Jacob ushered them to where their mounts could be corralled within the ruins to one side of the camp.
"We saw signs of horsemen yesterday. We didn't know whether they were friendly or not," said Blackstone, as he escorted Chandos into a makeshift shelter.
Half-broken walls screened with cut branches and covered with bracken. It served to keep some of the rain and chill out, and from a distance afforded a degree of camouflage. Blackstone bent and put flint to his archer's knife, sparking the fire that waited to be lit.
"We went without warmth and food this morning in case whoever it was came upon us was unfriendly. I didn't want our smoke or the smell of food to bring down an enemy on our heads. Better to have an empty stomach than our throats cut."
The dry kindling took quickly, and Blackstone swung a small cast-iron pot over the flames. The fire offered little warmth, but Chandos pulled free his gloves and held his hands near the flames.
"It might have been our tracks you saw, Thomas. I swear we've been going round in circles these past days. But there's a large band of routiers cutting across the Limousin. So perhaps they are closer than I thought. But I have news. You were close to the Harcourt family in Normandy, weren't you?"
"I was. When I was wounded at Crecy, I was taken there and nursed back to health. Godfrey de Harcourt served Edward, and although his nephew Jean de Harcourt fought on the opposite side, he became my closest friend."
"And he was slain by the French king because he and the Norman lords were planning treason, and you swore vengeance. Your life was turned upside down because of it."
"My king and my prince forgave me."
"Aye, well, be that as it may, Jean de Harcourt's brother, Louis, has come over to us. He's helping us seize towns and stop the routiers." Blackstone kept his surprise to himself. Louis de Harcourt was lieutenant of Normandy, and in the years before had refused every request from his uncle Godfrey to fight for the English.
"If that's true, then more French noblemen will join him. They'll realize at last that France has lost its power. That and the fact that half of them have been promised lands in England. But I am glad of their help. There are thousands of these damned routiers to stop. I wish to God Edward and the Prince had left the army intact to fight them, but that costs money, and the last campaign took much out of the King's purse. Chandos scratched a crude map of France into the dirt and pointed with a stick. They swarm, Thomas, and we face an ongoing contest between them and us. He drew a zigzag on the bottom of the map. These are the Pyrenees. The routiers were due to go and fight in Spain. He circled two areas. But here the princes of Aragon and Castile have forged a truce in their private war, and that has stopped the routiers from crossing over. A French army has been raised by taxes in the south. They're going to try and slow them, but we are to block any escape further into the heartland of France. Once the routiers reach the central massif, they'll find shelter, and the riches of Burgundy will feed them. Now, though, they have no food or supplies, and have turned back into Provence to lay waste to the Languedoc. Between them in the south, and war in Brittany here in the north, we might be caught between the two. The Bretons are the immediate problem, Thomas. They are gathering in ever greater numbers, and they pay no heed to Edward's demands because they fight on behalf of King John over the disputed territory.
And we are supposed to stop them?
Aye, before we deal with the other brigands. But we also have to take back the towns that have been ceded in the treaty. Some of these towns, however, are proving stubborn.
Blackstone stirred the pot. He had been commissioned by the king to retrieve, with Chandos, the towns agreed in the peace treaty, but there was still a frisson of rancor between the two men. During Edward's last campaign, they had fought together to seize a town, and Chandos had wanted the town's noblemen taken for ransom. But, realizing that the citizens lived in fear of the tyrant, Blackstone had slain him. If a ransom had been paid, the harsh ruler would have returned to terrorize the town afresh. Blackstone's actions gave the town its freedom and secured its loyalty to Edward. Nothing had been said about the incident when Chandos and Blackstone were thrown together by King Edward after the signing of the treaty, but it had not been forgotten. And now Blackstone needed Chandos's help to seize Saint-Aubin.
"Where's Sir Gilbert?" said Chandos, as the scent of herbs reached his nostrils from the pottage being slowly cooked.
"Sir John, I lost half my men, and Gilbert might be dead for all I know. Bernard de Charité in Saint-Aubin reneged on the treaty deal. He has the money we paid for the release of the town, but he ambushed my men, 20 archers and 20 men-at-arms."
Sir John grimaced. He and Blackstone had done their king's bidding for several months, and this was the first time a town had turned on them. Most had been relieved the fighting was over, and that the routiers would be brought to heel. Chandos or Blackstone would arrive at the gates of a town where the French king's letters were read out commanding his subjects to offer their allegiance to the English crown. The gates would be opened, the keys handed over, and then in the town square a garrison commander appointed. Once the arms of King Edward III were painted above the town gates, then Edward's men would ride on to the next town.
"Breton bastard," said Chandos.
"See what I mean, Thomas. The damned war in Brittany reaches here, where we least need it. All right, I can leave you 10 archers and the same number of men-at-arms."
"If Gilbert is alive, then I want to get him out."
"How?" "Saint-Aubin is a fortified town. 200 burghers and at least 40 fighting men inside the walls. You'll lose the other half of your men." "No, Thomas. Gilbert's fate is his own. We cannot risk more men. We have too much to achieve. I am gathering troops for an assault on the routiers. I have near enough 1,000 encamped with de Harcourt and Sir William Felton. He's been made seneschal of Poitou. They'll hold and wait for my return, and I expect your men to join mine. I'll have 160 men after those I leave with you, but we need hundreds more. The further south I can go before swinging east, the more I'll recruit. The Prince of Wales will soon be given Aquitaine to govern, and, as always, the Gascons have pledged their support."
Blackstone kept his simmering anger under control, but the edge in his voice was enough to alert Chandos.
"Sir John, I have known Sir Gilbert since I was a boy. He took me and my brother to war in 46. I will not leave him to rot, alive or dead."
"You will obey your king, Thomas,
and I am his voice here. If Gilbert is alive, de Charité will ask for ransom. We will negotiate. Saint-Aubin needs to be in our hands by whatever means possible. It can be ours if we storm the place and kill the treacherous bastard. I need your help."
"No!"
Chandos turned his back and paced, trying to calm his own temper.
"Thomas, he and your men are casualties of war. There might be a peace treaty in place, but we both know the fighting goes on. The civil war in Brittany pits us against those backed by the French and the Bretons who swarm across the land. There are few enough of us doing our king's bidding, but we must do it with the resources we have. He took a breath and gazed at Blackstone, who had not moved from stirring the pot. I forbid it, he said, and then, knowing Blackstone's reputation, do not defy me on this. Blackstone remained silent. He ladled pottage onto a tin plate and handed it to Chandos.
No friend of mine dies abandoned, Sir John.
Do you want salt? Chapter 4 Within hours the mist had lifted from the valley floor, and Sir John Chandos, belly full but heart clutched with anger, took his leave of Blackstone's camp. Their parting words barely disguised each man's antagonism. Blackstone was needed in 10 days further east to stop the advance of the Routiers who defied King John and made claim to the disputed Breton territory in the Limousin. Men like de Charité, who would ignore a treaty and disobey a king, but these Bretons were gathering in strength, and the handful of trusted men who rode with Blackstone would be useful reinforcements for Chandos. If Blackstone did not arrive in time, then Chandos would know that he and the rest of his men were dead. By the time Chandos and his soldiers had gone from sight, Blackstone had gathered his captains. They squatted around the same fire that had warmed the king's negotiator, but the crude scratch in the dirt that was France had been scuffed away. In its place were pieces of stone, laid out in an irregular fashion to denote the walls of Saint-Aubin. The gatehouse, the kitchen, the pantry, buttery, and the walkways were shown with pieces of twig. Spilled water soaked into the dirt became the lake, and handfuls of torn grass, the forest, from where Blackstone and his men would launch their attack.
Across the ice, said Will Longdon.
The night watcher on the other walls. No one will expect an attack from that side. It's their blind spot.
With good reason,
insisted Longdon.
If we get across the lake, how do we scale the walls? Asked John Jacob.
We don't, said Blackstone. Grappling hooks will alert them. We need one scaling ladder 20 feet long. We go through the kitchen window.
One at a time. That's asking for trouble, said Moulin. The servants will be sleeping there, and I don't know if either of us can fit through.
Will Longdon grinned.
I can see you stuck like a swollen cork in a bottle, Thomas. Trying to fit Moulin's shoulders in there might be like trying to push through a barrel of lard. If he gets stuck, even a prod up his ass with a spear won't shift him.
Perhaps we should ram a spear in your skinny ass and shove you up the latrine tower. You'd smell sweeter, countered Moulin.
Blackstone raised a hand to silence them. Whoever goes through that window first kills the servants.
You heard what Jack said. They mutilated our friends. They deserve no mercy. Perrine, you can fit through. So can Renfred and John here.
John Jacob looked at Jack Halfpenny.
How many servants in there?
6 or 7.
Blackstone's squire nodded.
3 of us can deal with them.
And in the main building?
The hall, the chambers? Well, another 10 or 12.
Aye, but they'll either be in the stables or sleeping in any doorway they can find, said Will Longdon.
Blackstone nodded. The main force of arms would more likely be billeted away from the main building with quick access to the main gate and square. Once he and his men breached the walls, they could be contained and killed.
Moulin, pick 3 men-at-arms to go through behind them. Each man with 60 feet of rope to lower from the ramparts for the rest of us. Will, I need you and at least 3 of your archers on the walls with them before the rest of your men join them. You'll fit through that window. Choose 2 more.
He pointed to where the walls angled away from what he hoped would be the blind side of the defences.
Each corner, left and right.
If the night watch sees us, you have to kill them quickly. Once we are inside the walls, I will go through the great hall with John and Perrine to find de Charité. Moulin will secure the square. Archers will take the walls. Their crossbowmen's billets will be by the main gate. Renfred and 6 men seize the gatehouse and its chapel.
The men grunted their approval. The gatehouse chapel served 2 purposes. It gave succour to the ruling lord, needing the solace of prayer, but also, being at the entrance of a town, was believed to keep ill fortune at bay. A belief soon to be dispelled by Blackstone's men.
"We don't know where Sir Gilbert is," said Jack Halfpenny.
If he's still alive, then they'll kill him the moment the alarm is raised.
Blackstone nodded.
It's a risk, but if he's alive, I'm hoping they'll use him as hostage. They'll try and buy their lives with his.
He looked from man to man.
Any questions?
There's no moon if these clouds don't blow over, said Perrine. It would be blacker than putting your head up a nun's habit.
He's right, said Longdon. It'll be pitch black out there, even with the ice on the lake.
Blackstone thought for a moment. The frozen lake would reflect what light there might be, but 40-odd men trying to negotiate across it in the darkness would be slow going. To have them scattered with the risk of going through the ice would put an end to the attack.
All right, he said finally, pointing the twig at Longdon.
We'll have the men cut pieces of the linen we use for bandages, a square of it to be stitched onto the back of every man's collar. I will lead the way. Ladder men behind me and then the others. We follow the white patch of the man in front.
The men murmured their agreement. The white cloth would show up sufficiently for them not to get separated and be able to follow a straight line to beneath the window.
Anything else? Said Blackstone.
The attack would be fraught with danger. If the kitchen servants were not silenced quickly, then the alarm would be raised before any of Blackstone's men could get inside. It could all go wrong in those first vital moments. Providing they simply didn't fall through the ice first.
The men shook their heads to answer his question. Blackstone snapped the twig. We attack before dawn.
Blackstone's captains took their men to the crude model that represented Saint-Aubin. The place had once been nothing more than a fortified keep surrounded by peasants' hovels. 100 years of change had made it a high-walled town with a gatehouse and a population of 200. Small by comparison to many, but a stronghold that had proved itself valuable to whoever held it. The surrounding area was rich in agriculture, and the town was self-sufficient. It had escaped the ravages of King Edward's War. No army would bog itself down with a siege for such a place, and that is why the people of Saint-Aubin thought themselves immune from attack. They were safe behind the walls, and they were protected by a knight renowned for his fighting skills. Each captain outlined Blackstone's plan, and the few questions asked were answered. Then they prepared themselves for the attack. They had to return 12 miles to the safety of the forest, where a long night lay ahead. Muscles would stiffen, and there would be no hot food or fires to comfort them. They ate whatever food remained in their cooking pots, and prepared to break camp. Men-at-arms cast aside their scabbards and slid their swords into a simple ring on their belt. They tore strips of cloth and tied them to their bridles to deaden the sound of their approach, in case Bernard de Charité had scouts beyond his walls. Will Longdon's archers cut and sewed strips of linen onto the collars of men's jupons. He went among the archers given to them by Chandos. Of the 10 men, he knew that no more than 4 had seen any serious fighting. Their chaff and banter told him so. The others were youngsters, strong lads who had been arrayed and brought under Chandos's command, but who looked nervous. When they tried to join in with the veterans' talk of killing fields, they were mostly scorned and driven back to silence. One of them diligently stitched a white patch, but Longdon saw his fingers were trembling. He knelt next to him, and without a word eased the cloth and the needle from his fingers.
"You'll be with me on the walls, lad. Do as I tell you, and you'll come through it well enough," he said quietly.
"I will, Master Longdon," said the archer.
Longdon deftly stitched one side of the patch.
"Not enough thread. Cut me more. Your name?"
"Peter Garland," the boy answered.
"All right then, lad. You'll do fine. You've been blessed with serving the bravest man I've ever known. He was once as nervous as you, but he learnt his lessons well."
"Sir Thomas,"
said Garland, breaking off more thread.
"Aye. When we went ashore at Normandy back in 46, we took the beach and settled on the cliffs in case the French were ready for us. Thomas was a 16-year-old boy who protected his younger brother, an ox of a lad, malformed, deaf and mute, but as courageous and as big as a bear. Bigger than Thomas, even. And Sir Gilbert, well, he's always been a hard man. He was Thomas's sworn lord. Not that that meant he was privileged in any way, other than having his protection. We teased Thomas about his father's war bow, because it had a draw weight on it that few of us could pull,
and we got him to loose an arrow at a crow in a tree. Sir Gilbert struck Thomas for wasting an arrow. He was a harsh master, was Kilbert, hard as nails. Hanged men who failed in their duty. But that day, back then, when Thomas could have pointed the finger at us archers, who had taunted him into wasting that arrow, he didn't. He took the blow and curses from Sir Gilbert and kept his mouth shut. I reckon whatever angels there are for the likes of us, they had Thomas Blackstone ready to be a leader of men even back then. He tied off the stitching and bit through the thread. You just do as the other lads do, Peter Garland, and you will see the light of day. He handed the jupon back to the youngster and patted his shoulder.
Thank you, Master Longdon.
Will Longdon got to his feet and stepped away. Perrine glanced his way. Will Longdon smiled. Here he was, mothering youngsters. Those who had served with Blackstone over the years cared for those in their charge, even though many would also know the lash of Blackstone's tongue. He pushed aside the embarrassment of being overheard by Perrine, and looked at the wall builder's men. They had felled a young tree, and tapped wedges into its length to split it. They had drilled holes, and hammered in hewn rungs. The assault ladder was light enough for two men to carry, but it had to bear the weight of a dozen fighting men clambering up it at the same time. Perrine had built many defensive walls and assault ladders over the years. As the men stood back from their labours, he lifted the end of the ladder and, using nails for shoeing horses, hammered three into each of the ladder's feet, to stop it slipping when it was set against the town's walls. Perrine caught his friend's arm.
"Will," he said quietly, "when Thomas rode out to rescue Jack, a buzzard circled. It hovered over him. For a moment I feared for his life, in case there was an ambush."
Longdon frowned. It was unusual to hear the veteran soldier express such heartfelt concern, but every man understood how an unexpected sign could be a forewarning.
"Perhaps it called for Jack. He looked half dead when you brought him in."
Perrine shrugged.
"Perhaps."
Will Longdon hesitated. How many times had Blackstone been close to death since he had known him?
More times than he could remember.
They were all mortal, and if the forest spirits had beckoned Blackstone's soul, then there was nothing any of them could do to stop it.
"It can happen to any of us, Perrine," he said. "And you know, wherever Thomas is, then death is always at his shoulder. I swear there are many others who will die before him."
Longdon heard his attempt at comforting them both ring hollow, but it was the best he could do.
"Your men have finished the ladder. They're waiting."
He turned away and let Perrine join his men, who righted their ladder and leaned it against another tree. Perrine pointed to two of his heaviest men and gestured them to test the ladder's strength. When the attack began, Renfred and John Jacob would race up the ladder with others at their heels. Any fault in its construction meant they would die before breaching the walls. The two men clambered up the 20 feet, followed by another two. Satisfied that the ladder could bear the men's weight, Perrine signalled them to take it and return to the camp. He scrubbed a hand across the crow's feet scars on his close-cropped head. A night attack brought its own fears. Thomas Blackstone had taken him and the men into battle many times, and not so long past had been trapped behind an enemy's city walls and had had to fight their way through the streets of Milan. They had been outnumbered and lost good men, yet some kind of divine hand had shielded Blackstone. Will Longdon's storytelling had reminded him of what he knew of Blackstone when Blackstone and other young men like him had stormed the walls of Caen. A dying Welsh archer had bequeathed Blackstone a pendant of the silver goddess Arianhod. The pagan Celtic charm had not spared Blackstone from personal tragedy, but she watched over him. Of that, Perrine was certain. He wished he had such a charm himself, but knew in his heart he would prefer a priest to give him absolution. No man wanted to die unshriven. If they survived the ice, then he would go through that window, and in the fight that followed, stay close to Blackstone. Perhaps some of the goddess's blessing would also shield him. Perrine spat and buckled on his sword. The time for idle thought was over. Chapter 5 Blackstone ran across the ice towards the dark shape of Saint-Aubin-le-Fur's walls. Dull glow emanated from the small window.
The cooking fires in the kitchen had been bedded down for the night, the embers deep in the grate's ash ready to be brought to life the next morning. The glimmer